Support for the Front Porch comes from WVCarFinder.com, matching West Virginia cars with West Virginians who want to buy them. It's a service of the Charleston Gazette-Mail. More at WVCarFinder.com. And you're on the Front Porch. This week, we're going to talk with Garrett Ballingy, Executive Director of the Cardinal Institute for West Virginia Policy. Hey, Garrett, how you doing?
Doing just fine. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming. We're going to dig into the Institute's conservative prescriptions for taxes and spending, as well as ask Garrett about his own decision to come back to West Virginia as part of our Struggle to Stay series. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I'm joined, as always, by Rick Wilson, goat herder, hillbilly philosopher, proud liberal, and with the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
No problem.
And also Lori Lynn, lawyer, conservative columnist, who tweets at WV Pundit. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
All right, let's dig into it. Let's start with the personal, and then let's move to the policy. So, Garrett, you grew up in Parkersburg. You graduated with honors from WVU, Ohio University, worked in D.C. for 4 years. So why'd you come back to West Virginia?
There's always, and I think most people that are from West Virginia will understand this, there's always that pull to come back. It's always, can I come back? Can I make a difference? Can I help make the state a better place? Can I be close to my family? Can I sort of be back in the hills and that sort of thing? So whenever the opportunity came open to come back, I had to jump on it.
And I have to add here, for people who don't know Garrett and can't see him, you probably qualify as a young person in West Virginia,
yeah.
Right?
28, so I think that's fairly young for West Virginia.
Was this going to be something that you felt was going to be good for your future career, or is this something that takes you off of a track that being in a bigger city like D.C. would lead to in the future?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if I necessarily weighed it that way. It was, is there something that I can do in West Virginia that can potentially make a difference? And is that, can I do that within the next 5 years? And I think that answer is yes. So whatever happens after then, we'll see. But I think there are a lot of opportunities to make the state a better place. That was sort of my calculus on the decision to come back.
Now that you're back, do you feel like you're back for good, or is there a chance that an opportunity could take you somewhere else, or is it kind of like, here I am?
It's like, here I am.
Yeah.
I very, very much view me being here as, I'm on a mission, if that sort of makes any sense at all, in whatever small way I can make a difference. But, you know, I saw a lot of my old colleagues and friends in D.C., and they were like, well, so how is it? You know, what is it like? Why did you go back? And I said, you know, the adjustment is there. Like, I had a relatively tough time adjusting despite spending the first 20-some years of my life here. So what do you like about it? It's like, well, I'm an hour and a half from some of the best hiking on the East Coast. You're not going to find too many groups of people that are friendlier once they get to know you than the people in West Virginia. One of the things that I really noticed, and maybe this sort of just goes to that sort of Appalachian cohesion or whatever, but one thing I noticed here is people always say, be careful. And I'm sort of wondering why that is, some of the psychology behind that. You know, people that I barely know, it's like, oh,
what
have
do you
a
mean
great
by
day.
Be careful?
Just take care, something like that.
Yeah, after you get done with sort of the niceties and you throw a couple sentences at each other, it's like, oh, have a great day, be careful. And I'm like, that's an interesting little idiosyncrasy, and I'd like to dig into that.
Is it
sometime.
Because West Virginia is an inherently dangerous place? Lovely, but dangerous?
I say that all the time, too, even
really?
Like the emails and stuff, yeah.
So, but are you thinking of it as be careful, or is it more just like take care?
A little of both.
Okay.
Interesting. All right. Well, that's a side issue. We'll do a whole show on
yeah.
Take care, Appalachia.
Get a psychologist in here or something. We'll dive into that. But
so you're here as the executive director of a relatively new public policy group, the Cardinal Institute. Talk a little bit about what it is. What it's here for, who funds it. Let's just get all that out on the table.
Yeah, sure. So the Cardinal Institute was formed in September of 2014 around our chairman's breakfast table, Keith Pauley. You know, they thought there was a real gap in West Virginia for sort of free market type of thinking. So they thought, well, wouldn't this be kind of cool to have something like this here? A lot of other states have similar think tanks and research organizations. And so then I interviewed with them in June. Starting September of 2015, and we want to introduce free market ideas to the state because we think that's something that the state desperately needs, and we think the record of history is quite clear that free markets are sort of the way to prosperity and growth and economic well-being. So,
heads will explode if I don't ask you about this. The thing that's always said is that this is a quote-unquote Koch brothers enterprise.
Right.
Explain that.
Yeah, I mean, the Kochs are sort of this bête noire of the left. It's sort of, they try to bring that up in order to discount the message or the messenger. So I worked at the Koch Institute in D.C. for about 4 years, and I worked there for the same reason why I came back. Again, I believe in the power of individual freedom and economic freedom and liberty and free markets.
Why is it called the Cardinal Institute? What's behind the name?
State Bird. Yeah. Someone's like, is this a St. Louis Cardinals thing? I'm like, no, I'm a Dodgers fan.
You didn't know that?
Well, it's sort of, I have to say, I have a little quibble with the name of it. I always harken back to the, you know, the left-wing organization, the think tank here, which is the West Virginia Center for Budget and Policy, right? Mm-hmm. Which sounds so official. Mm-hmm. It sounds almost like it could be a state agency. And the way they do their logo, they have the grid in the background. It looks very scientific. And so when you guys came with the cardinal, I thought, well, you know, it sounds a little, I got the, it could be a bird, but it also sounds a little religious. And, you know, I found myself wishing that it had been, you know, the West Virginia Center for Policy Analysis.
Something,
just because it's a real pet peeve of mine that the way people cover that organization, you know, you have journalists here in West Virginia who, if somebody has a meal paid for by the Koch brothers, they run to their word processor. But when they talk about the other organization, it's just, you know, sometimes it's mentioned as progressive, but
it's left leaning, labor funded, even though labor gives
but
about
they don't
1
always
or 2%.
Say labor funded.
We talk about the funding and that sort of stuff. It's like let's debate the issues on the merits of the issue.
Yeah, I'm continually shocked by the number of people who think that just saying Koch brothers is an argument.
Yeah.
And you know, we've talked here before about the Koch brothers and they have some actually very progressive ideas about, for example, criminal justice.
Is a huge thing, although, again, I'm no longer employed there, nor do we really have any more contact. But it's, you know, I want to argue and debate the issues on their own merits. And I think that the funding issue is a way to sort of attempt to discredit people. Just engage with the argument and go from there. I think whenever you do that, you sort of try to cast people in like an evil sort of light or whatever. And I don't understand why we can't be civil on some of these things sometimes.
Let's talk about taxes and spending. You just came out with a big report on what we should be doing about taxes in West Virginia.
Yeah, so we co-authored a study with the Beacon Hill Institute in Suffolk University, which has done this for a number of state legislators. You know, generally speaking, I don't want to get too boring here, but it's what's known as a dynamic modeling system. So given changes in economic conditions or budgetary issues, you're trying to follow that change through the economy, right? So if you would expect economic behavior to change if you reduce the tax rate from, say, 99% to 1%, right? So this model tries to track how that economic behavior changes. So we ran a bunch of different simulations. So, for example, getting rid of several brackets of the personal income tax, getting rid of the severance tax, sort of tax swaps where you increase a sales tax but you decrease personal income tax, right? So you try to find what that correct tax architecture actually looks like. So yeah, we're in about 15 different scenarios.
Well, talk about if you could wave a magic wand and let's say fix or change two or three things about our tax system that would make it more productive, more fair. What would those be based on this analysis?
So I would say one of the main things is to begin to get rid of income tax and in order to make that revenue neutral, make that up in a sales tax.
Why is that?
In general, I just think consumption taxes are a better way to fund government services than income taxes for a number of reasons. One to me is a moral reason. It's unclear to me why we should be taxing people's income whenever it's something they simply have to do to survive. Whereas a consumption tax, I mean, that's somewhat voluntary, right? You can sort of choose when you pay into it. And honestly, it's also a less volatile income stream. That's one of the reasons why we see so many problems with the severance tax. It's a very volatile revenue stream. I think everyone in the state now knows.
I think those general consumption and sales taxes tend to be regressive because low income and working people have to spend more of their incomes on the basic necessities. So that would be one thing I would flag, I guess.
Yeah, how high would the rate have to be?
We didn't actually do like that It's tough to say. It would depend on a number of variables, and also depends on the number of years your analysis is. And it's true on the regressivity point, but that's also why I'm not a huge fan of the cigarette tax, for example, why a lot of people push the cigarette tax. It's also a highly regressive tax and also extremely volatile as well.
So the other thing I thought was interesting in here, severance taxes. The analysis says that cutting the severance tax wouldn't really have much economic bang for the buck. Why is that?
There's sort of a couple different theories that we sort of floated around. One is a lot of these are sort of out of state, so a lot of the benefit would flow out of state, if you will. It's also relatively small compared to the tax as a whole, right? So everyone pays an income tax, but not necessarily everyone is affected by a severance tax. So it's also just a different magnitude and different scale as well.
I do think that severance taxes are nearly all exportable, especially for gas. It's not really paid much here at all. And in fact, if you could even arguably increase the tax on severance tax on gas, and you would merely at the most delay the extraction of it. I mean, it would still be extracted at a different point. So
see, that's the analysis, right? It's how high can you go before they stop mining and stop drilling?
You guys had done a report on wild, wasteful West Virginia. You identified a lot of places that you could see the state budget being cut. Can you talk about maybe your top couple of those that you would recommend?
Yeah, so it's been a couple months now since I've looked at the report. Sort of getting away from the report maybe just a little bit. We didn't really look at this too much, but just the idea of how many public employees do we have? What is the average salary of a public employee? Is that something that we can sort of take a look at as far as getting our public sector down to size as far as maybe average of other states or something like that.
Yeah, what about public broadcasting? That gotta be fun. I mean, you got these overpaid idle drones sitting around here. Scott, you probably have a portrait of Trotsky in your office somewhere.
Do we really want to do a whole... We could do a whole show on this. I worked in Tampa, Florida for 4 years. And to serve 4 million people, it took one transmitter. Also, you could drive anywhere within the region in about an hour and a half. Everything was easier. It took less people. Here we have a 27-tower transmitter delivery system.
What percentage of your budget comes from the state?
So first of all, we're a state agency. I don't know if people know that. We are actually a state operation here. We used to have about 2/3 of our funding come from the state of West Virginia. After this year, we'll be more like 45%. It's gone down pretty substantially year after year. And the way we've dealt with that is that we've raised more private money to make up for the fact. Our donations in West Virginia are really strong. They're just lower. So we have lots of people giving us money. We have 10,000 people who are members of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Their average gift is about 20 or 30% lower than the national average. So,
fundraising letters are really well written, I want to say.
The final thing is we do a lot of things for the state that you might not know about. In emergency services, we have towers that we upkeep for state emergency services. We also have a fiber link that if there's any ever natural disaster or something, we can provide satellite service for the Office of Emergency Services, for the National Guard. You know, these are things that we don't charge the state for. But I do think we have a value to the state. And if you ask nationally, ask taxpayers, what are good uses of their funding? Top is national defense. And public broadcasting is often 2 or 3. It's something that people really believe in as an educational resource.
I'm not necessarily, obviously, this won't surprise any of you, a huge supporter of state funding for public broadcasting, but it does fill a niche. I mean, it is solid programming that is informational and intellectual and enjoyable, and a lot of people listen to it on their ride home. Again, you and I may differ on scale as far as, you know, the need for public funding of that, but
and I would just
so definitely
ask,
kudos to you guys on that regard.
You know, my only thing would be, Rick, is, and I just find it fascinating how much you love to bring this up as our token liberal, et tu, Brute.
But it was a joke, Scott. It was irony.
It's
you got all defensive
joke,
about
so
it.
So funny. But moving on. Well,
one state expenditure that I think is very difficult to defend, it doesn't have very many defenders, is the Greyhound breeding
subsidies,
program
yeah.
subsidies. And what is that, like $20, $30 million
a year?
Yeah,
last I saw was like 25 or something like that.
There are very few people who defend that, and yet year after year, it lives on. Can you talk about that? What, you know, politically, that's just the kind of thing that it benefits very few fairly influential people, and it's just, it's very hard to kill things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of political theory 101, right? It's just, you know, diffused costs and concentrated benefits. It's just very easy to get a small group of people fired up and down at the Capitol because, like, this is a massive portion of their livelihood or income than it is to get taxpayers riled up because 5 cents of their weekly paycheck is going to Greyhound subsidies. So that's what we're trying to do as an institute, is try to figure out what are those concentrated benefits, to whom are they going, and what can we do to publicize a lot of those things. I think people see that and they think, well, geez, if that's there, there's got to be a lot of other stuff.
I just wish there was a state subsidy for Great Pyrenees dogs, you know?
Why?
More of a Scottish Terrier guy myself.
It's very hard to get lawmakers to go in and tinker with the budget at that level because of those pressures. It's a lot easier to say 4% cut across the board, you know, you guys, administrators, figure out how you're going to do it. That's just a lot more palatable.
There's a French philosopher called Bastiat, and he talks a lot about the seen versus the unseen, right? And so when you go in there and you try to tinker with the budget, if you will, or you try to maybe lay off public employees or something like that, that's a very tangible thing. People see that. Those are their neighbors. These are real people, right? But what you don't necessarily see are the families who don't have enough money to, you know, buy groceries that week, or they can't send their kids to daycare because their taxes are going to something that really isn't defensible from a proper role of government perspective.
And you recommend something I think is kind of interesting. It's almost like a base closure commission, an independent person or group that's able to make recommendations about these changes. Describe that a little bit more.
Yeah, so it was the 70s or 80s, it was the Brack Commission, wherever, in order to provide essentially political cover for politicians, you had this independent commission of people that just made recommendations on, we should probably close this military base because of X, Y, and Z reasons. It's not efficient, it's not helping. And so they would do that, and they also had they had the power to recommend these sorts of things. And then the politician would go up there and rail, oh, you can't close this. This is important to my community. But then he could also say, well, it's really out of my hands. And so we recommended something fairly similar, just a group of taxpayer advocates, maybe retired legislators, people from essentially all political persuasions to sort of get together and see what can we all agree on that really needs to get axed from the budget. And again, we can provide those recommendations and then our lawmakers can do with that what they will.
Well, it starts with an assumption. And the assumption of your group is focus on spending cuts. And if we had Ted Bettner here from the Center for Public Policy, Budget, whatever that is, I think the disadvantage of that name.
The thing with the graph paper and the logo.
It looks official, but I can't remember what the name is. But if I had Ted Bettner in here, he would say the focus needs to be on taxes and raising.
They call it revenue.
Oh, sorry, revenue.
Right. Yeah.
So it goes back to something we talked about a lot in here over and over again. What's the basic model for getting us out of our morass in West Virginia? Is it an investment model? Rick would talk about a dozen investments that he feels like we need to make in human capital, basically, in order for us to get out of there.
Not to mention things like roads.
And roads. and to do that, you need money.
And the fact that we've cut hundreds of millions of dollars from the state budget over the years, and it hasn't exactly proven it. And then there are states like Kansas where Governor Brownback said the tax cuts would be like a shot of adrenaline to the heart of that state's economy. It was more like a shot to the heart without the adrenaline. So
there's that model. And then the other model is, no, let's make our state a low-cost, business-friendly environment that will draw business here and eventually will bring in tax revenues that will allow us to invest. And you can't really do both at once, right? You have to make choices. So talk about the choices you think the state should make.
Sort of my mental model when I think about this is you have two extremes, right? So you have, let's just say, a 0% tax rate. I don't think any of us would necessarily agree that's a very good thing. On the other side of that, you have a 100% tax rate. Again, I don't think any of us would think that's a very good thing. So the question is, on what end of that do you want to get closer? And I think the record of, as I stated in the beginning, I think the record of history is quite clear that societies that tend towards free markets, high levels of entrepreneurship, limited government, reasonable tax rates, tend to do better than those that go further and further towards that 100%.
You say that, but what's the evidence of that? I mean, I could give you California or Massachusetts, high-tech
states. Well, if you look at two of the most successful economies in the world, Hong Kong and Singapore, they're also the most economically free countries. The United States, the history of the United States. China's growth pattern started after the Farmers' Revolution and the introduction of private property rights in the 70s. And you just look at it from a logical basis. You think of incentives and, you know, serving each other and trading with each other. This is essentially what free markets are. People just sort of like to cast it in a negative light.
So if I'm someone who's wanting to expand my business in West Virginia, something we hear a lot is that you can't find properly educated drug-free workers, that is the limiting factor. Well, how do you deal with the lack of educated drug-free people in the state unless you have resources somehow to tackle those problems?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I tell people, you know, West Virginia's got a lot of issues. I mean, you could locate Google's headquarters here and or another Macy's manufacturer. You still had to bus people in from outside the state. To me, I think you have to introduce something like school choice. You have to introduce competition into the equation in order to force everyone to improve their product.
Now, let's talk about school. This is interesting. So school choice, I lived in Florida. We took advantage of school choice. Everything I've ever seen says that it's a wash in terms of whether you have greatly enhanced educational outcomes in states that have school choice as not. So that might be something that parents appreciate. I don't know if it's going to fix our education system or even save us money.
I don't think it'll hurt. And I think it's incumbent upon us to try something new. That's also another West Virginia idiosyncrasy. We're very tyranny of the status quo here, a famous quote from Milton Friedman. We're always hesitant to try something new. And I tell people it's usually because they prefer the devil they know to the devil they don't.
Because you have to take care.
Yeah, exactly.
The world
yeah,
is a right. dangerous
And I think that
place.
Is probably part of that mentality and that psychology, but it's quite clear to everyone, I think, in this room that what we're doing isn't working. So why not try something else? We'll give it 5 or 10 years. If it's not working, we'll do something else. But I think we owe it to our children and those people that, you know, will struggle to stay here to try something new and introduce a little bit of choice, which we all enjoy, you know, when we go in a grocery store or whatever.
To follow on to that, the legislature in 2015 passed this alternative teacher certification that was basically going to allow groups like Teach for America to come in. And they kind of inched toward doing that. I think a couple counties were kind of looking into it maybe last fall. And just the outcry. I mean, we were talking about having 2 or 3 teachers come in per county and in just a couple counties, say 10 new teachers. And just there was an article, I think, in the Gazette about, you know, it was like a fear. And it was like you were saying, the status quo, just a tiny little change. And just the way people freaked out about it, it was really kind of sad, just that they were so threatened by even just this really small incremental change to the way that you know, education had been doing its business. So yeah, I've definitely noticed.
Yeah, I mean, humans are just by their very nature risk averse.
But
right?
I think it here, I think there is something in this state that, you know, resists that. Change.
Yeah, and that's probably goes back to some of that Scots-Irish psychology and, you know, why people came here in the first place. I mean, but just humans by their nature are risk averse. So you have to demonstrate, you have to give people evidence, and which is hopefully what Cardinal will do in the coming years, that, you know, change could be a good thing for us. Like, let's give it a shot.
So what's West Virginia's competitive advantage then into the future? A lot of people are saying the coal industry will never come back to the level of prominence it had. Do you agree with that, first of all?
I think that's unknowable.
Okay.
Who knows?
Predict the future.
Yeah.
All right, I won't make you do that.
Yeah.
But what do you think that West Virginia can and should be building its economy around that's going to be something we can do that other places cannot?
That's a tough question. I don't think you're going to like my answer because it's going to be there's going to be a lack of specificity, but it's just sort of the way I view things. I think if you set up the correct environment, so if you have a strong educational system, if you have an environment that encourages entrepreneurship, if you have an environment that encourages people to try new things, who knows what that's going to look like? You know, I sort of believe in this theory called spontaneous order, that you can't really design things. You just have to like create the environment and then whatever comes will come. But it's basically impossible to predict that. I think 20 years ago, North Dakota and South Dakota would have had no idea that they would experience the sort of growth that they are as a result of the
gas. Or the bus they have now.
Well, again, that goes back to the inherent volatility of certain industries, right?
Well, what's a state that has done this well? Kansas was mentioned before. Let's talk a little bit about Kansas. It's going through some rough times now. I guess the question you might, the answer you might have is that, well, it's way too early to know whether the experiment of Kansas is going to work or not. But go back farther in time. What's a state that has followed these prescriptions that you've seen succeed and that we could follow as a model?
Well, I think Texas is doing quite well, especially whenever you compare it to a state like California. I mean, there's a mass exodus, it's my understanding, from California to Texas of people opening up new businesses there. Austin is a huge tech hub. You have to understand, like, states are competing against one another, and there's a reason why companies want to locate or are continuing to locate in greater numbers in states that have low cost of living, that have a low tax, a friendly tax environment, and a strong education system.
Yeah, then you look at states like Minnesota that have actually increased the progressivity of some of their taxes, and their economy is really thriving. They have very low unemployment rates.
I guess it depends what you call success, because, you know, Garrett's right. You know, you look at the states that have the highest population growth, the most economic growth, it's states like Texas that have done this sort of lower tax, lower regulation path. You have people leaving California, but you have a lot of people that are doing very well in California, too. And ironically, Rick, I'll throw this at you. I think California is having more of a divide between rich and poor because of that. California is increasingly a society of very well-off people that can afford to live in a high-cost society, and lower-income people that are really struggling to afford housing. They've dealt with that by what? By raising the minimum wage now to $15 an hour over time.
Well, I'm thinking about Woody Guthrie, who said California is a Garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or to see, but believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the do-re-mi.
So you're saying that's always been the way for California. Well, but what about Texas? I mean, is that seems to be the model. Low tax, low regulation.
They do have a couple panhandles, too. So I guess our situations are really similar. I wanted to go back and circle back about something about West Virginia's economy. Like, it's really, I'm thinking about 10 years ago, a WVU professor at the time, Russell Sobel, put together a book called Unleashing Capitalism with some similar support. And the irony of all that is, if you know anything at all about West Virginia's history, it was really unleashed with a vengeance over 100 years ago, that West Virginia basically has been a mineral colony for the last 100 years with a lot of wealth sucked out of it, with a huge percentage of our non-public land owned and controlled often by out-of-state corporations, as Tom Miller, who I believe has worked for you, documented in his report. And to pretend like that is not a factor in our economy and it's because we're this liberal overspending thing, I think that's a little...
That would be the question. Do you disagree with any of that analysis, that a lot of where we are today is because we were this colony, basically a mineral colony, largely owned by out-of-state interests?
In fact, West Virginia was one of the first states to actually pass a sales tax, a consumer sales tax. This was right at the time when huge amounts of wealth were just being taken away on trains, so it's just kind of interesting.
I'm not sure if I necessarily, I won't claim to be an expert in that particular as far as public lands or things like that. I mean, that's something that we can empirically test. So, but I would say the idea that resources are either a curse or a blessing is unclear to me. You take a look at something like Hong Kong. It's a rock literally in the middle of the ocean. I don't know how many of the companies that are there would be considered Hong Kong companies versus European companies or American companies or something like that. And they're one of the wealthiest nations in the world.
Because they have human capital.
Right. Or you look at something like, and I certainly wouldn't advocate this, but you look at something like Saudi Arabia. This is also a very wealthy country, and it's got an abundance of natural resources. So again, I'm not sure it's a question of the resources. I think it's a question of the environment with which you set things up. I mean, Hong Kong is successful because of the British common law system, right? It was a spontaneously created legal system that people understood that was logical. Again, a very low tax environment, and companies flock there, and I think we see the evidence of that right now.
So the politics of West Virginia have changed a lot, probably even, I guess, shortly before you came back. The legislature changed, and obviously it's different from how it was when you grew up. What is it like kind of being part of the new, I guess I could maybe be considered part of this too, but the new right here? Is it
Do y'all have like a club? Like a hangout?
Well, there is a secret handshake.
It's an old speakeasy on Capitol Street now.
Not the same as the Muslim hand signs that one of our delegates said the president uses, though, right?
I have this conception of the state, which Rick may disagree with, as being dominated by, you know, the left and really venerable left-wing institutions, right? Organized labor, things like that. But that is changing. Do you feel a resistance more or less than you expected? What is it, even socially?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question.
Do people sort of hiss Koch brothers at you in the supermarket?
But this is the other thing. You're on the side of the population of the state. Your ideological viewpoint is in alignment with West Virginians. Do you feel that?
Yeah, it's that's a good question. It's tough for me to say just because I wasn't really here. I wasn't like politically active or engaged or anything like that prior to my leaving, really. I'd say there's equal parts excitement and also, man, I hope this can last sort of thing. Like, we have sort of one shot.
Is it really a sort of a fear that things really could flip back?
I think so. To me, thing? I'm not, and I don't know if this is true or not. This is just my opinion. I don't know if sort of the quote conservative revolution in West Virginia is necessarily because of a newfound love for conservative principles, or if it's essentially a backlash against Obama and like EPA policy and things like that. I think that's a possibility on either side of that. If it's the former, then I think we're in for some good years ahead. If it's the latter, I'm not really sure that we can continue on the current situation.
I'm not going to ask you, quote unquote, do you support Trump? But what would your analysis be of the rise of Trump's popularity among Republicans, independents, and Democrats in West Virginia? What does that say about conservatism in West Virginia?
So I did a town hall meeting a couple months ago, and a lot of union guys attended, and it was a good discussion. But the one thing that really kept coming up was free trade. These guys are absolutely terrified of free trade. And I think there's a lot of that in Trump. That's why he has a lot of support. I think a lot of people in West Virginia feel like they're on the razor's edge. So they're just making it, but just one slip up could really be something bad. And I think a lot of people see the reason why they might slip up is something like, quote, cheap labor or something like that, or Chinese dumping of steel. I mean, whatever it is, whatever your issue is. And I think they view Trump as that guy that's going to stop.
Isn't there some truth to that maybe the economy as a whole has benefited from free trade, but a lot of the people that have not benefited happen to live in West Virginia?
Yeah, exactly. And I've had this discussion with several people. Like, change creates winners and losers. I mean, it's a fact of life. The question is, does it create beneficial outcomes for the majority of people or does it not? And if it doesn't, well, then we need to look at this. If it does, it's very unfortunate that it hurts some people, but this is simply the progression of an economy and life in general.
You know, one of the things that's frustrated me is this idea that solution to our problems comes from outside. And whether that outside force is government or some big factory that's going to come in. Like, whenever you talk to folks about how we're going to deal with our job situation, well, we got to attract some company to come to West Virginia, and that'll fix it. You're talking about entrepreneurship. You're talking about growing our talent and getting people to realize that they can create their own opportunities. Do you see that happening in West Virginia among your generation? Do you see more people doing that?
I think I see it in spots, right? So like I go to Fayetteville or Lewisburg or something like that. I'm like, there's no reason why we couldn't have this just on a much larger scale in Charleston or Huntington or Wheeling or Parkersburg or wherever. There's no reason why entrepreneurship can't be our sort of saving grace, if you will. But I have noticed that as well. And I think part of it is, you know, you're sort of growing up and then, you know, Daily Show comedians like to make fun of West Virginia, right? I don't know if you guys saw that tweet, like, not that creepy West Virginia, the Hillary won the good Virginia or whatever. And I think West Virginians, they grow up hearing that. I think it sort of creates a sense of either A, we're going to band together and just give a middle finger to the outside world, if you will. Or a lot of people say, man, I need to get out of here. There's a stigma almost of living in West Virginia. And I'm not sure if there's that many states that can have that sort of negative claim to fame. So I think that sort of creates like this urge on some people, like, I just need to get out of here. I can't tell people I'm from West Virginia anymore. I'm not a hillbilly. I have all my teeth. I wear shoes. So I'm going to go to, you know, Maryland or Texas or Virginia. So
there are very few places in the United States that have such a strong repellent force and such a strong draw at the same time. It's endlessly fascinating to me. Rick Wilson, so you say you're going to come up on the spot with a Bible verse for this week. Do you have one?
Oh, yeah. Listen, we were talking about the Koch brothers earlier. Jesus said it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God.
So is the idea that the state should assist the wealthy man in getting into heaven by relieving him of his
wealth? I think the state pretty much does have his back with the whole Roman army thing. So,
thank you guys for having me. I hope you guys will invite me back at some point. And this was an engaging discussion. I hope your viewers and listeners feel the same way.
Have you and Ted Bettner ever been in the same place at the same time?
I don't think so. Although I'm sure if we did, there'd like be a black hole open up somewhere and, you know, time space continuum would start to bend or something like that.
I think that could be really interesting. I do appreciate you being on here and, you know, submitting to all these random questions. It's really good to have a deeper conversation.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's just very important to have a marketplace of ideas, right? Just the same way that competition is good for grocers and cars and telephones and technology in general, it's important in ideas as well. May the best ideas win out, but it's important to have that debate and competition in the first place.
Outside of the competition of ideas, if you were to challenge Ted Bettner to any other competition, what would it be?
I did a pizza eating contest once in Parkersburg and did pretty well. At least during the competition. Afterwards, not so much. But
is it speed or quantity?
Quantity. You had to eat the whole thing.
You wouldn't know this looking at Garrett. <I know. laughs> he's like one of these skinny little guys that wins the hot dog eating contest.
That's right.
But
That's right.
They brought the pizza out, and it was literally the size of the entire table. And if you didn't eat it, I had another partner. If you didn't eat it, you had to pay for it, and it was like $70 pizza.
So
and
then you this challenge at Hillbilly Hot Dogs. You ever been there?
I haven't, and I really want to go.
Yeah, I think it's
the line is awful long.
It's huge.
Is that the one that's in a bus?
Kind of, yeah. Okay. It's long route too. And yeah.
What's the challenge?
This huge, ungodly hot doggy thing, or maybe a burger thing too, that if you can actually eat it.
Oh, wow.
I forget what the reward is, but you probably wouldn't live if you did, so it wouldn't really.
It'd be like John Henry?
Yeah.
Like oh, that yeah. would be that.
Yes. Steel driving man, right?
Hot doggy.
Hot dog
man.
Plowing man.
On that, you've been listening to The Front Porch with Garrett Ballingy, native West Virginian and executive director of the Cardinal Institute for West Virginia Policy. Thanks for coming on, Garrett.
Thank you.
Rick Wilson of the American Rent Service Committee, and Lori Lynn, conservative columnist and lawyer, tweets at WB Pundit. And by the way, one more thing. Did you know you can listen to all your West Virginia public broadcasting favorite shows on demand? More and more people are discovering the podcasts for Mountain Stage, Inside Appalachia, and even The Front Porch. Download our podcast on your smartphone, and you can listen on your own time. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for listening.